Busy city life makes it hard to think about and work at integrating our faith with our lives. Welcome to the Cathedral Podcast, produced and hosted by Jenny Ho Huan. Each episode, we want to help you relate core Christian truths to your daily life. Whether it's science, philosophy, cultural trends, or life stories, we bring you authentic and unrehearsed conversations to spark insight and strengthen your faith and your life.
Hi, everyone. This is Jenny. Today, we are going to talk about a subject that is a little bit uncomfortable for most of us, but it's an important subject because it's real in many people's lives. And in fact, it touches all of our lives in one way or another. Before I tell you what the subject is, let me tell you who is here to talk to me about it. It's none other than Rafael Chang. Is that how I pronounce your surname, by the way?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, Rafael Chang. You graduated with a master's in English, but that's not what we're going to talk about, okay? And you were actually about to further your studies, but you felt your heart was drawn to issues affecting the family. So today you are program strategist at Focus on the Family, which is a charity organization that helps families to thrive at different stages and phases of life. Thank you for being with us, Rafael.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. So, would you like to tell us what is the subject of our conversation today?
Yes. So today we're going to talk about the very uncomfortable but important topic of pornography. Yeah. And I think it's a subject that's very close to my heart, having really struggled with this issue as well. And funny story, when I first came on staff at Focus, I wasn't supposed to really be speaking or training, but I had an opportunity to develop a talk on pornography and masturbation. And then after the talk was developed, a colleague asked me, would you like to give this talk? And I said, no. But being Christian, I said, let me pray about it. Mm. And so I prayed about it. And then the Lord said, well, you had asked me to put you in places to promote sexual wholeness in the churches. Why don't you answer your own prayer? And so I think this subject and a lot of this content is very close to my heart for all these different reasons.
Thank you so much, Rafael. Why don't we begin with maybe a definition of pornography? That may be helpful for us. What is considered pornography?
Yeah, so in Focus, we do acknowledge that there are many different definitions of pornography, but for our purposes, we would define it as porn as referring to any material, printed, visual or audio that depicts sexually suggestive or explicit acts. It is basically anything designed to cause excessive and inappropriate sexual arousal. So that's like kind of like the matter of fact kind of definition. But we also want to acknowledge that for different people, different types of content can be considered pornographic to them due to maybe different past experiences or different contexts that we're in. Yeah. So that's how I'll define pornography.
Okay, I think that's a good definition. And it's true. I think different ones of us are sensitized to different things. But your definition therefore covers audio, visual, right?
And
so it can be online stuff and print. So, of course, we know the famous Playboy magazine. And then nowadays, there's also sexting, which is on the phone. That can also be considered pornographic if it has that kind of impact or effect on the person.
Yeah. And emotional porn as well, like eroticas. So they're not visual, but it does, I think, cause us to imagine certain things excessively, which is not good for our thought life.
And of course, the famous 50 Shades of Grey, that sort of thing. Not to be confused with Grey's Anatomy. Okay, because they were both quite runaway success, unfortunately. More one unfortunate than the other. Anyway, now then, why don't you tell us from the Christian point of view, why do we consider porn sin?
Well, let's just start with the heavy subjects, right? I think different people would consider it a sin for different reasons. But I think for me, I would say there are three aspects of it. It dishonors the Lord. It does dishonors us when we use it, and it dishonors others. So I think porn oftentimes involves lust. And lust, as we know, is all about taking. It's very inward-looking. It is selfish. And that is in direct contradiction to the nature of a loving God, and God has the nature of being outward looking and self-giving and self-sacrificial love. Yeah. So I think it's a sin because it departs from God's nature and God's purposes for us. And so it dishonors us because when we use porn, it does harm us and it undermines our ability to be a pure vessel for Him, to be a pure temple of the Holy Spirit. And of course, it dishonors others because when we objectify the people depicted in porn, we are disrespecting them. We are really kind of disregarding that the Lord had made them in His image. They are to be cherished and loved and respected, and they have a unique destiny. And so then we fail to treat them with dignity when we objectify them for our own needs in that way.
Mm. Okay, you started by saying that this is more or less like a personal stand or conviction, but you're not saying this is a personal opinion.
No.
The basis of your stand or your conviction is biblical, because you have reference to how God made us and the nature of God, who God is. He is loving and self-giving. Mm. We are made in His image. We behave and experience life best when we are also self-giving and learn to look at others the way God sees them. There's this concept that you mentioned just now that's very interesting called objectification. Mm. Can you tell us more about that? How does that happen?
So like the term suggests, objectification is treating people as if they're objects. So as we know, when we relate to objects, we don't respect it, we don't treat it, we don't like consider its feelings. I mean, when you sit on a chair, you're not going to like, oh, is the chair going to be upset with me? You know, we rightly speaking use objects, but we're called to love people. However, in the process of objectification, we, instead of loving people, we actually use them instead. We see them as objects to be used for our own purposes and then discarded. And surely that's not the way we are called to love people.
Mm. All right. That's a very important point. And in fact, objectification is a growing tendency in our consumer society. We actually can increasingly treat all our relationships as, and we judge them, right, based on whether it serves us, it makes us happy or not happy, whether we're triggered or not triggered, et cetera, yeah. So objectification is just a broad, maybe cultural tendency right now in our world, something we need to watch for, because it really dehumanizes people. And of course, in porn, it is extremely prevalent that, or rather, it's inevitable that will happen, because the focus is just your personal pleasure, your personal satisfaction. And of course, if you're using porn, the people on the screen are people you don't know, right? They're complete strangers. And yet you are engaging somehow and opening yourself at a most vulnerable, most open, most exposed way to a complete stranger you have no relationship with.
So obviously you're objectifying that. Mm. I really like the way you put it, like dehumanization, because I think I don't know about other people's experiences, but I think when I've really had to struggle with this, when I sometimes take a step back and think this is someone's son or daughter, right? And like, I remember I read this quote that said, if you were to look at people the way their parents had looked at them when they were first born, that would really significantly change the way we see and relate to people. And I just think, if I would take that step back and to consider that about the people depicted in porn, then wow, that really changes the whole experience, right? Like, these are actual human beings who are loved and cherished, first of all by God, and then also by their community, their family.
That's a very important point, just to be able to take a step back and think that. Well, okay, Focus did a survey across churches in Singapore, and I think we had some quite surprising results. Would you like to share that with us in relationship to pornography?
Sure. So we have this assessment tool called the Whole Life Inventory. And what I'm going to share actually comes from a collection period of 2016 to 2018. And we surveyed 13,790 Christians from 30 churches. And they range all the way from age 13 to 70. So I think some of the pertinent stats in this area would be 81% of all respondents said that using pornography goes against their beliefs and values. I think that's encouraging, but of course can be better lah. Because you should be 100%, right?
Yeah.
69% of respondents have viewed porn in their lives. 63% of the male respondents we surveyed has viewed it in the past 12 months at the point of taking the survey. For female respondents, it's 22%. Mm. We have found alarmingly that the earliest age of exposure is 0 to 6 years old. Although that's not the most.
Did you just say 0 to 6 years old? Oh, dear.
Yeah. So even though that's 1% of the people we surveyed, 1% of 13,000 is 130 respondents, which is too many, right?
One is too many. Oh, my word. Yes.
Yeah. But most people, we found 48% first view porn at the ages of 13 to 19. This is not directly related to porn, but I do think it speaks into the issue. On the family front, when we asked respondents, can you turn to your parents for help if there was a sexual issue? Only 34% of youths and 16% of young adults said they could turn to their parents for help. When it comes to churches, only 41% said they could turn to someone in church for help if they were facing a sexual issue. So I think these are troubling findings that when people are facing these issues, they are not really able to turn to people in the home or in the church, which should be the safe places that they turn to people for help for. Yeah.
Okay, thanks for telling us that. So the stats reveal quite a few things. Number one, the church is not immune to this whole area, which we will develop and talk about more. Of course, it's also very troubling that we have more than 100 kids from 0 to 6 who may have been exposed to it, which means that these are young children who somehow have been targets, or they have been given devices, or there are books lying around somewhere that they have come in contact with. Now, to the point about the young people saying that their families will and their churches may not be the first recourse, because only 30% would turn to the family. I think, is it possible this is directly linked to the fact that there's this whole element of shame related to pornography? Would you like to speak into that a bit more?
Yeah, I think definitely there's the issue of shame, but also I think so from what we understand, if parents have not already had conversations like this about sexuality, say like what is good touch and bad touch, what is considered your private parts, which no one is to touch except for your parents, and all these kinds of conversations, the safer types, then it's very unlikely that when our kids are facing something a lot more serious that they will turn to us. So I think that's one element. But I think shame is definitely also something that contributes to people not speaking up for help, asking for help. Because I think the very nature of shame is that shame causes us to want to hide. If you think about Adam and Eve, right there at the beginning in the garden, when they had done something wrong, they felt ashamed, they hid themselves. And to the point that the Lord had to ask, where are you? And not so much because God doesn't know, but because he wanted them to articulate for themselves, hey, where are you right now? Could you tell me? So I think shame does that. I think what is particularly painful about the feeling of shame is that it is different from guilt in the sense of guilt would say, I've done something wrong. So that's related more to the behavior. But shame says, something is wrong with me. It has to do with your identity. It's very deep-seated. And therefore, I think that really inhibits people from wanting to seek help and to talk about an area that they are ashamed about.
Yeah, but that precisely is difficult for most of us to distinguish, because I feel like we are a very performance-based society. And most of our kids are raised to think that you are basically what you do. I mean, like, you are your grades, you are how, you know, you are how popular you are, or you are how you look, etc., etc. So I think that is very blur for most of us. So even if I go to church and say, oh, God loves me, you know, you're a child of God, la-di-da. But the larger culture, or even at home, you know, the messaging I'm getting is completely different. And that's what I imbibe 6 days of the week. So that is going to be very hard. I mean, once I think I do something wrong, I just really want to curl up and hide from everyone, and maybe even put on the front. I mean, we have heard stories told of Christian leaders, right? And a few who have quite famously this past year fallen away from the faith, where they were struggling with things, and they also said that, you know, actually, I don't know who to turn to. I have nobody to process this with. And that was such a huge burden that it eventually, as it were, proverbially broke the camel's back for them. So this is a really important area to look into. And I think we should not look into it just because we are dealing with these specific challenges or difficulties or whatever. We should go upstream a bit and look at how we are parenting and how we are discipling in church, where we can clearly help people to distinguish between your doing and your being, as it were. Although they flow one into another, no, but which is more primary, which is more foundational. Yeah, I'm sure you agree with me.
Yeah, no, I think that's excellent. And I feel like the more I think and speak on sexuality, I find that often the root issues are not with sexuality, but with the larger, it's more cultural. For one example is that, do our churches have a culture of authenticity and vulnerability? Or is it that when we go to, say, small groups, there are more respectable sins to confess and share, and then there are certain sins that we don't really share, and there are certain things that we would prefer to talk to, say, non-believers about, because then we feel less judged than in church if we had shared them. I think all of this kind of like are symptoms that we really need to pay attention to. Because even if we kind of like face this issue of shame, even with non-sexuality issue, then what more when it comes to sexuality issue, where often it's seen as taboo and stigmatized, then even more people won't share.
You're quite right. So how about from your personal experience, how did you manage to tear away from this cloak of shame? How do you manage to emerge from that secret place? What helped you?
Wow. Well, I don't know if I have completely gotten free of it. I must say shame is something that is I'm really still working through, which is why I've given so much thought to it. I think for me personally, with the Lord, knowing His unconditional acceptance and love, simply knowing that even if right now I sin very badly, God's love for me does not change a bit at all. You know, He would love me the same as before I was born. He would love me the same even if after I'd done something I feel very ashamed about. I think somehow that really sets me free from shame. What I had used to do was say the issue of pornography. When I had used pornography, I would use shame as a strategy to leave it. I'll beat myself up. You know, I would say, "Oh, how can you do this again? God already set you free. You told the Lord you would not do it again, and yet you are here doing it again." And so I'm trying to shame myself into leaving the behavior. But what I eventually found out in my experience, and I think through research, was that shame actually becomes a driving force for me to turn again to unhealthy coping mechanisms like porn. So I think when we use shame as a strategy, it actually is a self-defeating kind of approach when it comes particularly to this topic, but also to other kind of coping mechanisms that we have in our lives.
That's a very interesting point that you raise, because I think we also live largely not only in a performance culture, but in Asia, we live a lot in a shame culture. Like your parents last time were like, "Shame on you, you know, how can you do this?"
Yes.
So I think there have been PhD studies and all that done on the shame culture and all that, and TED Talks as well. So you guys can go listen to that if you like. But it's an important distinction between shame and guilt. The Bible is very clear that we have guilt. And the Bible is also clear that there is a way to deal with guilt. Yeah, so I think at some point, Raphael, for you, the whole shame thing you're trying to push yourself out for didn't work. Maybe the tipping point was when you saw it not so much from the perspective of shame, but you begin to shift into the space where you realize this is really, truly, objectively wrong in the eyes of God. And then you are confronted with a very concrete decision, not just a miasma of feeling bad about yourself, which only drives you to try to find something to relieve you of the bad feelings, because we all hate to feel bad about ourselves, right? So we got to go and buy bubble tea or whatever, try ourselves out. All explicit material. Those two are very strange examples. But anyway, but like you say, you know, I mean, sometimes shame just drives you to seek relief. But so for you, was there also a kind of a turning point where it moved more into guilt? And were there people in your life to help you in that journey?
I think because most of my journey with sexuality, I struggled alone. A lot of it was just stumbling around. And I think one of the key turning points for me was, so I used to think that I need to earn God's love and acceptance, right? And so how that works with pornography use is, oh no, I've sinned, I've fallen, I'm not worthy to be in His presence, then I'll like backslide. And then I will need to do things to earn my way back into His acceptance and love for me. But of course, that is very self-defeating. What eventually turned the whole thing for me was realizing that even after I'd sinned, God still loves me and accepts me. And then I think that's where I really understand that verse in the Bible in Romans, His kindness leads us to repentance. It's from a place of knowing that I'm still loved, that somehow that motivates me to walk better. And so I think often in this struggle, I have found that sometimes it's not really the falling into sin and into porn that is the most destructive, but it's the recovery process. Do you fall and fall into despair and spiral from there? Or do you fall and then learn to pick yourself up? Because the more we practice that, the more we're actually able to journey into freedom. So that's what kind of like I've learned for myself. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the whole process of getting up again. Well, I mean, the Bible says the righteous man falls 7 times and gets up again. So we are not immune to falling. Some of us are more, have 2 left feet, so we fall more often than others. And we all fall in different areas and in different ways. But I think the call is for us to run to God and not run away from Him.
Yes.
And pick ourselves up. But you also mentioned a tendency that's also very common, which is we try to compensate, you know, that we serve God more, we lead more worship songs. But that hypocrisy will eat us up, I think, because it's so inconsistent with what's going on. And yeah we know, because we come into the presence of light and then it's just all this darkness refracted over in our souls. It's very confusing. It's very, it's just very distressing, I think, after a while. So the encouragement to everyone as we struggle with different weaknesses as well as temptations and sins is to run to God. And if picking ourselves up is hard, really, I think the power of confession and authentic community is built into the church for that. Although it's built in, something we have to learn because it's unnatural to most of us still. Okay, now let's shift gear a little bit and talk about why in the first place porn gets so addictive. How does a porn habit develop?
Why, yeah? Well, I think porn in itself is something that is very, very powerful and stimulating. Often it starts very innocuously. People turn to it for out of curiosity, or they accidentally stumble onto it and they feel like a thrill and an excitement. And then what people then tend to do is they will return to it. And then over time, they might expose more and more to themselves more and more to it. And that's where they become desensitized. They build up a tolerance for it. And so what maybe you used to like serve for 2 hours a day, and over time, that will not be enough. Then you will want to increase it to 3 hours. And after a while, 5 hours a day is not enough. And you want to serve a more hardcore kind of pornography. And so desensitization then leads to escalation. And for some certain people, escalation will lead to acting out sexually, where it's no longer enough to just use pornography, but they might be tempted to, say, act it out with people, maybe with upskirting, maybe with inappropriate sexual touches. Yeah, and I think also addiction grows because sin thrives in secret, as all of us knows. And when we have a double life, when I don't confess my sin, I can be worshipping in church and serving fervently and doing all those different things publicly. But when no one knows about this part of my lives, no one will hold me accountable to it. No one will be there to lovingly speak into it and say, hey, about this part of your life, I don't think it's doing you any favors. Yeah, so I think when we have a double life, we don't feel very compelled to bring this to a community and bring it into light. Sometimes because we don't know who we can bring it to. And as we know, the enemy holds what we hide over us. That's where he gets his power.
Yeah, someone has said that you can't unsee what you've seen. You've heard that, right? So when you talk about the whole process of desensitization and escalation, there is something also going on in our emotions, in the stimulation, but also something going on in the brain that is corroborating with this process, which therefore makes the path towards addiction happen, right? Would you like to describe that to us?
Yeah, so I think the neurobiological processes that porn triggers, I think this was for me one of the key moments as well in my journey. Because I think in the past, I used to think, oh, porn is just a private thing. Who does it affect? It's just me. I have control over this. I can stop anytime I want. Until I realized what porn is actually doing to my brain. And so what I eventually found out was when we use pornography, there's a number of neurochemicals that are released in our brains. And these same chemicals are released whenever we have sexual activity of any kind. Would you like me to mention all or just a few key ones?
You like chemical names? Rattle away.
Yeah, so I'll just mention 3 key ones and then another 3. So the main ones that we will often hear is dopamine. Right? So when we use pornography, and especially when it's coupled with masturbation, there is a feel-good hormone that's released. And dopamine is our reward system. Whenever we accomplish something, our brain wants to reward us for that. That's why dopamine comes in. When we use porn, oxytocin And vasopressin is also released. Oxytocin more in women. Vasopressin more so in men. These two hormones have to do with building attachment and connection, right? So oxytocin is called the bonding hormone. It's released during childbirth. It's released when women are breastfeeding their kids. It's also released when we hug people for more than 8 minutes.
Oh, okay.
It's when we clear closer to them. Vasopressin is more present in men, and it's also been dubbed the monogamy hormone or the loyalty hormone.
Mm.
So when men have sex, vasopressin makes them want to be loyal to the person with whom they have had sex. Yeah, which of course, sidebar, that's why sex is reserved for marriage. I think that's why this is a wonderful and safe context for it. So I mean, there's all these processes involved. It makes us feel good. It makes us have feelings of attachment and connection. There are also other hormones. So there's norepinephrine, which gives us focus and energy and a sense of euphoria. There is endorphins also released, which gives us physical pleasure. And after orgasm, serotonin helps us to feel more relaxed. Yeah, so all of these things are kind of like collaborating together to make pornography use and masturbation such a wonderful, enjoyable experience, right? Because if it's not wonderful, no one would be hooked on it. Yeah, and I think what I also further found out was that these chemicals are properly meant to be released and triggered in the act of sexual activity within marriage. But when we have sexual activity outside of marriage, your brain is not going to only release them when it comes to moral sexual behavior, right? It's not going to go like, oh, this is the right context, therefore I will release all this like attachment, connection hormones, right? And then, oh, this is a premarital sex, so I won't release it. No, I mean, God just designed our bodies in a certain way, and it's for us to learn to abide and by that design.
Which means with the use of pornography, then you have had certain experiences which, when you are having, say, sex within marriage, or when you are still single and you're preparing for sex for marriage, it's the same set of chemicals that are being released, the same set of euphoric sensations, but you've already had that outside of that context. So, you know, so I think it will interfere. If not, it will distort, or it will, I think it will. I don't know, that sounds to me like there's going to be some kind of interference with the actual healthy experience, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So I've heard of stories of men who, before that, there is this misconception that, oh, I'll just use porn because I'm single, and once I get married and I can have sex, then like porn won't be a problem anymore. I've actually heard people say that, but I've actually heard stories of men who, after having sex with their wives, would go and surf porn. Because for so many years, they have trained their brains to find sexual satisfaction with the screen, with pornography, such that when it comes to real-life sexual experience with their spouse, they would not find that to be satisfactory. And also, there are other studies that talk about how porn can bring about porn-induced erectile dysfunction. And a lot of younger men are experiencing now because of the impact of porn in their lives.
And also, I think when our brains keep going over certain things, there's some grooves, right? They are like train tracks inside. And it's just very easy to engage those train tracks. I mean, it's not just porn, it's many other areas of our life. Just as some of us just fly off the handle very easily, it's because of this repetition and reinforcement. Yeah. And so our brain just begins to wire up differently. So when it's wired up differently, then even though you might think, you know, this is wife, this is screen, but they're actually very different things.
Yes.
And your wiring is really set to go one way. So when you're having another experience, which is supposed to be similar, it's actually not the same. And your brain is going like, this is not the thing, you know? And so, so I can imagine, with pornography and the variety it offers you, I think being faithful to one spouse can be very challenging.
Because I think we are actually, the more we use porn, the more we are actually changing, physically changing our brain to want more of it. And I think, especially with the kind of many different kind of variants of pornography out there, which I shall not name, but there are many types, we are actually teaching our brain to find pleasure, connection, and meaning with these different types of pornographic content. We're actually training ourselves to prefer it, such that when it comes to, real life experiences, we actually find it to pale in comparison. That's why people keep returning to it, because nothing else in real life will give you the same high, so to speak.
That's so awful, isn't it? That's really truly the power of a counterfeit. Huh? Mm. And if we are not careful, a counterfeit can really hold us in its grip. So what can intercept and break this hole? What are some resources that may be required? We mentioned a little bit earlier about turning to God and accountability and all that. Are there other things? Are there resources out there that can help?
Yeah, I think first of all, knowing all these different things about how porn affects our neurobiology, awareness, I think, is very helpful. I know sometimes we say, oh, this is just head knowledge. But head knowledge is a very good place to start as well, to just kind of be aware and to really just ask ourselves questions like, is this what I want to be bonding myself to? Is this, if I look at my life going ahead, is this where I want to be 5 years from now? So I think awareness is important. Other things, of course, that are helpful would be accountability software, which you can find on the internet. Covenant Eyes, there is Accountable to You, there is X-Tree Watch. There's actually a whole host of accountability software out there. And on this, I do want to make a note that there have been studies done that people who use internet filters without accountability, that means they only use blocking software, but they don't really have a accountable relationship with anyone to really process these things with, they are actually found to be more likely to use porn.
So they
feel more tempted, and then they feel frustrated that it's blocked, and then they begin to devise creative ways to get around the filters. But people who use accountability software, that means blocking software, but you're able to, say, nominate an accountability partner who will get your internet history or the screenshots that you've been, the screenshots of the things you've been viewing, and then you have someone to process these things with, that actually reduces that likelihood of them returning to porn.
That sounds more
effective.
That sounds like the forbidden fruit syndrome, right? The more
further
outreach it is, the more you curiously want to like access it and prove that you can. I think with certain personalities, maybe the type A personalities, it becomes like a challenge to them. And they have to like, wow, I'm going to... Yeah. So I think being aware of all these things, and most importantly, being aware of yourself. Being aware of your own stress levels, whether things are really... you're really in a bad place emotionally. You're having some really deep unmet needs. And you need to figure that out, because it's easy to fall into these things. And because our eyes cannot unsee. And once there is pleasure, it's always addictive. We are designed for joy. So we are designed for pleasure in that, God designs us that way. But pleasure in terms of joy. So this counterfeit joy, which comes quite easily, but not free though. I know that porn sites, a lot of them got to pay one, right? So it's not free.
I don't know.
It's a bit troubling because I heard that during the COVID-19 season, porn sites are offering their services for free. Because people are stressed, they might turn to it. So I think we just want to round up our conversation by saying that what we have shared so far shows that porn is nothing. It's not private. It may be secret in terms of how you feel about it, but before God's eyes, it's in clear, broad daylight, you know. And it's not only personal, because once you objectify people, you get into that habit. It may just be something that leaks into all your other relationships with people, you know, this tendency. And then we are dehumanizing, which is a criminal thing to do, especially for a Christian. We believe that we are really precious in the sight of God. And being aware that our brains are actually being rewired really warns us of the dangers of it. Yeah. So any last words, Rafael?
Well, I suppose to round off, I would just say that I think when it comes to pornography and people who struggle with it, oftentimes they feel a lot of guilt and shame. And I think if I were to say anything, I'll just say that when God looks at us struggling with porn, He is not ashamed of us. We may feel a sense of shame and guilt, but God is not ashamed of us. In fact, I think if anything, He is heartbroken. And I think that porn in itself is not the thing. It is just a coping mechanism for something else in our lives. So I would say, to start that journey, I think, of finding freedom, I think practice curiosity. I think really try to be identifying what are some of the unmet needs in our lives, what are the pains in our life we're trying to soothe or self-medicate with pornography. Because even if you get rid of porn and these unmet needs or past hurts are still there, you will just find another possibly unhealthy mechanism to find that quick relief again. So I do feel like once we attend to what is it that's really driving us to pornography, and begin to meet these needs in a healthy way, or begin to bring healing to them, then I think porn will have less of a hold in our lives. And of course, it's still important to practice accountability and put different boundaries in place, and that will take care of the pornography addiction part. But as a whole, we want to pursue not just be free from pornography addiction, but we want to pursue wholeness, right, in all the areas of our lives, because that's what the Lord desires for us. So I think I'll just say that, because it's been incredibly helpful to me to have that understanding.
Yes, I think it's always powerful to have a vision that we can live into. And that vision is what Jesus promised us, the abundant life, a life that flourishes, that glorifies God, and that is that flows out in many ways to bless other people. And each one of us have that potential as well as the capacity. And certainly when we are struggling with pains, or when we are addicted to things like pornography, that sort of really interrupts and messes with our life in a very big way. And also it has effects on our entire ecosystem of relationships. So on that note, I really want to thank you, Raphael, for this wonderful and very honest conversation with us. We appreciate you so much for sharing your life with us, your knowledge and your journey. God bless you, Raphael, your amazing wife, and your wonderful baby.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much, Raphael.
Thank you for listening in. We hope you've been encouraged with some new thoughts on faith and life integration. You can find us on the Cathedral app, iTunes, Spotify, or at cathedral.org.sg/podcast. Be sure to join us again.